God, major steps will be taken in this regard.
من نمونه ای از کارهایی که دولت در این مدت کوتاه انجام داده به شما اشاره کنم.
Let me give you some examples about the achievements by the government. 7,000 production units have become operational. They were almost shut down, but they have become operational again. Many engineers and workers and experts have actually started working there. There has been considerable decline in the unemployment rate. This has been unprecedented. And also there has been a rise in the foreign and domestic. There has been a rise in domestic and foreign investments. And also medical insurance has expanded, and there has been a growth in transit, growth in production, growth in economy. We said that prior to this administration, in this administration, we had 4% growth.
And
of course, this year we will also have economic progress, and based on the efforts made by industrialists, it's feasible to have a higher economic growth rate. Today we have growth in economy and production, and there has been the decline in inflation in the process of production. What I want to tell you is that there is the capacity, there are ample capacities for work, and the future is very bright. We believe that the future will be very bright,
and
we have started activities in the infrastructures. There has been, there were 22,000 megawatts of electricity. We had that deficit, but we have managed to compensate for that, and there's no doubt that in the near future we will become an exporter of electricity in the region. Also, speaking of water shortages, that's been the case, has been followed up. We have taken action to resolve that problem in 10,000 villages. 3,600, we have resolved water shortage in 3,600 villages, and we will overcome this problem. And we are just pursuing cases of imbalances, and the science-based companies have hit the figure of 10,000. That's the number of these companies, and their role in production has to hit the figure of 10%. And also, speaking of road connections from the east to the west, from north to the south, this has been followed up, and these measures are compensating for the past in water, electricity, energy, road construction, and other infrastructures for production. The academic centers have become active in these areas, and they have been in contact with production units, and joint efforts are being made. And with the grace of God, we will realize progress. That's a major duty for the administration and the officials. We are certain that with the assistance of the people, the problems will be resolved, and the progress, more and more progress, will be made in the future. The enemy is after disappointing the people, and the enemy has always failed. What are they looking for? We believe we have ample capacities, and
استقلال را در حوزه اقتصادی نیز مثل حوزه سیاسی برای کشور
efforts can bring about economic independence, like political independence, with the help of the people. Many of these problems that people suffer from can be resolved. And the administration is based upon the people, has come from the people, and through public participation, many of the problems can be resolved. What is our duty today is to create hope. 22nd of Bahman and the 10-day dawn means creation of hope. Creation of hope among in the Iranian nation and world nations. The issue of Palestine today has turned into it was a top priority issue for the Muslim world. It has now become a top priority issue for humanity, and that's been due to the steadfastness of the Iranian nation. World governments should know, but as the leader said,
and
in order to hamper the crimes stop the crimes of the Zionist regime, all countries must sever ties with that regime. Our proposal is the expulsion of the Zionist regime from the UN.
رژیمی که 400 بیانیه قطعنامه
400 statements and resolutions have been adopted by international organizations, and the regime has violated all these resolutions. How can it remain committed to UN Charter? We believe that one of the major steps that has to be taken is the expulsion of the Zionist regime from the United Nations.
ضمن تشکر از همه شما مردم عزیز از عزیزان بسیجی نیروهای مسلح جوانان
the people, the besieged forces, the armed forces,
در این راه پیمایی عظیم حضور داشتید
young people who participated in the rallies, and I also wish to thank all the domestic and foreign journalists who reflect this glory to the world. I thank all the people in urban and rural areas and all the organizers of this glorious event and the Islamic Propagation Coordination Council and all those who were involved in this event. I wish to thank them all. And I hope that your prayers would be responded by God on this glorious event. And hopefully the Zionist regime would be destroyed. And hopefully we would celebrate in the near future the victory of Palestine, and also with the help of the infallible imams, the problems would be resolved with your capable hands and through the efforts of this government. Some may consider this as far-fetched, but we do consider this as very likely, and it will be realized in the near future. Thank you very much.
Welcome back. This is the live coverage of the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran.
And you've just listened to a speech, a keynote speech by Iranian President Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi. And just a quick recap of what President Raisi said. President Raisi mentioned that in his speech on the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, he said, "The enemies of Iran have engaged in economic, trade, psychological, and all sorts of warfare, the latest of which was hybrid warfare against the Iranian nation." He said, "The Iranian nation, in February of 1979, with their revolution, effectively substituted grace and dignity for humiliation. And the Iranian people still chant, neither East nor West, and they have remained true to that slogan." President Raisi said, "We take orders from no one, neither from the East nor from Western powers. We're a power in our own right." He said, "Progress of Iran is contingent upon participation of people in the elections." President Raisi said, "We have made substantial progress, remarkable progress in peaceful nuclear technology, in manufacture of defense systems, drones and various defense systems. We stand first in the region in production of science. Iran has attained first rank in region in terms of research in science and technology." He said, "Iran is the flag bearer of the fight against terrorism in the world today." President Ebrahim Raisi said, referring to the events in the Gaza Strip, he said, "Bombardment of the Gaza Strip must stop." He said, "The time has come for the death of the Zionist regime." He said, "The city of Al-Quds must be liberated." He also said, "Iran, the Iranian people have decided to live with dignity." He said, "The Iranian government has pledged and remains true to that pledge. It will fight corruption in all of its forms." He also mentioned, he also listed the achievements of his government. He said, "We have produced 7,000 new production and manufacturing units. These have been established, and this has been a source of employment." He said, "Growth in transit of goods and commodities has been quite considerable. There has been significant growth in production and manufacturing sector. We've had economic growth. Inflation is on its way down. The future is very bright for the Iranian people. We have a very bright future ahead of us." He said, "Iran will soon become an exporter of electricity to other countries in this region." President Raisi said, "Knowledge-based companies have been established. Thousands of knowledge-based companies have been established. Over 3,000 villages have had their water shortage problem solved." And President Raisi said, again, referring to the conflict between the Israeli regime and Palestine, he said, "The issue of Palestine, long a top priority within the Muslim world, is now a top priority for the international community as a whole, for the entire world."
And I think the most important thing that President Raisi said, actually one of the most important things that he said, was our proposal is to kick out the Zionist regime from the United Nations.
That's right. President Raisi said, "Because the Zionist regime for a very long time has ridden roughshod over various United Nations resolutions, refusing to abide by any UN resolutions, President Raisi said the Islamic Republic of Iran proposes the expulsion of the Israeli regime, given its history, given its bleak history of not abiding by any UN resolution. Iran proposes the expulsion of the Israeli regime from the United Nations.
And I think it's now good to cross over to Press TV headquarters, where we continue other discussions and other interviews. And this time there is an interview with Masoud Shajare, chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Let's go there.
That's right. Stay with us for continuing coverage of the 11th of February rallies and marches.
Despite, you know, the whole world, I mean, let us not forget the imposed war. 8 years of Iran not just fighting against Saddam and Ba'ath Party, but against the whole world, which was supporting that. And, you know, it was victorious. This is really incredible. This is almost a miracle. Then sort of what is achieved militarily, what is achieved sort of holding on to its values. And, you know, this revolution is not just for the Iranians. This revolution has been for all those who want to stand against colonialism and imperialism, and has given them help and support ideologically, and inspired them all around the world. What we are seeing, the resistance in occupied Palestine, is actually a fragment of that sort of inspiration from the revolution, and from the fact that you have to stand up and resist against colonialism, against oppression. And really, I think when you put all these things together, these 45 years have achieved beyond anyone's imagination. As I said, I remember vividly at the time of the revolution 45 years ago, that the West and Western sort of powers were whispering that it's going to be just months, not even a year, that is going to be undermined and is going to be removed. And now, 45 years, despite everything, we are seeing what we are seeing. And today, looking in the streets of Tehran and seeing these masses of people from all different backgrounds, old, young, children, are out supporting this revolution. It sort of it gives the feeling that this is going to go on and on and on, and it will be victory after victory.
Indeed. Let's bring in now the other guest that I mentioned, Karim Sharia, is an Iranian affairs expert who joins us from Beirut. And we also have Batul Sabeti, activist and political analyst, who joins us from London. Welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Batul Sabeti, if I may, from London. We're looking at the 45 years of this Islamic revolution. I'd like to get your thoughts on how maybe you became familiar, not just with the revolution itself, but its ideals. And then perhaps, if you followed it, see how that has translated throughout the years and decades, and where you see it really showing itself.
Absolutely. What inspired me the most about the Islamic Republic and what made it stand out is the fact that it brought forward policies that have not been seen before in the dirty world of politics. You know, the Islamic Republic, it added this new dimension to the political system of governance through showing the world that actually principles ought to overshadow a nation's interests. You know, that's to say, interests need to be built on core principles. You know, of course, a nation's interests is very important. They can't be ignored. Nations need to be ambitious. They need to collaborate. But it's interests that are built on principles that is missing from governmental practices and policies of the past and the present. You know, that simply lack ethics and morality. So in the context of Iran, we see that the bedrock of the revolution is one of having an open hand policy for all the oppressed nations, you know, no matter their religion, their sect, their ethnicity. And many examples, you know, can be given in this regards. You know, it's not just the Muslim Ummah, you know, it's not just the Palestinian struggle for justice or defeating Daesh, for example. You know, Iran has even given, you know, practical and moral support for entities like Venezuela in the face of US sanctions, you know, despite further sanctions Iran has had to face as a result. results. So Iran commonly looks for the common interests with other parties, whilst dealing mercifully in this kind of long-term strategy, which not only informs, you know, the security and the military operations, but it also looks to build institutions, you know, that serve people and nations where there's a willingness for the other parties to work with them. You know, so for example, if we take the Iraqi case, the ensuing vacuum that was created in the Iraqi economy and the national infrastructure during the US invasion of Iraq, that was accommodated for, you know, through the support of building its institutions, the supply and export of electricity and fuel, you know, the support of martyred families, you know, for example, through the Shahid Foundation that has many branches in Lebanon, Palestine, Nigeria, etc. So Iran has demonstrated this model for the past four decades of principles overshadowing a nation's interest. But not only that, but Iran ultimately seeks to create this new world order, right? This new world order that's based on, you know, principles of expertise, growth, mutual respect that ultimately necessitates the elimination of monopolies and aggression and the imposition of interests at the expense of people's interests. And this should rather be built on those aspects that I spoke of. And that's something that actually Iran has proposed even 1.5 decades ago when Ahmadinejad, you know, took onto the platform on the United Nations and he made that statement. You know, so I think it's because Iran has this free and independent model, and that is the greatest threat to America, not the fact that it could no longer go into Iran and jeopardize its resources or, you know, exploit its resources. That's more secondary. The primary threat of Iran is this model of independence that has spread across the whole region, that's almost contagious in a sense, that right now we see that Lebanon managed to liberate itself from the shackles of the Israeli occupation entity because of that free model of Iran and the inspiration that it got from it. Same thing that we're seeing in Iraq today as the American troops are forced to withdraw. You know, the same thing that we're witnessing, the liberation of Palestine in real time, wouldn't have happened without the 1979 Islamic Revolution, because that is when the Palestinian file was seriously put on the table and seriously taken into consideration.
All right. Karim Shorar, when our guest star talks about independence, that is one of the things that Iran has been able to do, because it has basically, well, it got rid of the Pulse Shah at this point. We know that that was a very big and pivotal moment in history when the Islamic Revolution came about. But the idea of independence is something that Iran has been able to act on. And at the same time, there are certain things that have come out of that independence. One of them is the whole notion of resistance. For example, it has the economy of resistance when it comes to its economy. But then there are, for example, resistance groups. Tell us how that spurred these resistance groups and why they liked and were admiring Iran in that respect, to follow Iran's ideology.
Well, as your guest Batul said, this all goes back to the fact that Iran follows a not just principled politics but also a principled foreign policy. So when you take into account the fact that the very tenets of Iranian foreign policy are built on wisdom, as outlined by the leader Ayatollah Khamenei, wisdom, expediency, and pride, the very fact that you have pride factoring into this principled foreign policy, despite the great deal of pragmatism that Iran has shown over the years, the very fact that you have pride as a principled tenet of this foreign policy means that anything that diminishes one's Iranian pride or Islamic pride or touches on anything that may damage Iran standing across the world, this will immediately lead to such foreign policies being sidelined. So the very fact that you look, for example, at the let's take into account the fact that the revolution came about during the Cold War, at a time when you had to adhere to one of two camps, either East or West. When you change an entire system at such a pivotal moment in history, and you look at into the fact that Iran is located at the dead center of the Eastern and Western camps, coming out of this Western camp, despite all of the pressure that the U.S. has put on Iran to remain adherent to this Western camp, And being able to say neither East nor West, independence, to cry out for independence of the against the posturing that is taking place in the world. This in and of itself was a show of resistance. Now, when you adhere to Islamic tenets, when you add Islamic tenets and Islamic principles into all of this, this means that you also need to factor in your duty as not just a Muslim, but as a human being, to support any and all attempt to liberate oneself from either the Eastern or the Western camp. This isn't because Iran at that moment was trying to assert itself as an important geopolitical player, as you would have all these pundits saying. No, this is because this was an actual duty that reflected itself on the individual, collective basis in Iran. And the people plain and simply actually believed that it was their duty to support any and all resistance movement anywhere across the world. So it's not just Palestine. You have to take into account that Iran also supported Bosnia, despite them not being Shia Muslims. So again, this also dissipates the idea of there being any religious or sectarian posturing by Iran. If you also take into account the fact that Iran has always stood for any and all attempts for liberation. So as Batul said, the very fact that Iran supports Venezuela against the Western attempts to corner it and blockade it, Iran's relations with Cuba. So this, it's important to keep in mind, just to wrap this up rather quickly, the Iranian revolution was not just a political revolution. It was not just a principled or a religious revolution. It was also a cultural revolution. And I think that's why the main reason, also as your guest said, why the United States and the Western camp is so adamant on trying to undermine this revolution. It's because it brought forth an entire worldview that had been thought to be something of the past. Mm-hmm. It shook the very core of the U.S. worldview and its attempt to impose itself on the world.
All right, so Master Shajar, to kind of merge what our guests are from London said and what our guests are from Beirut said, in the context of this new world order, we're looking at the Islamic Republic to somewhat define itself. I mean, when it comes to the slogan of neither East nor West, well, that was at a time when the West was maybe acting as one, so to speak. But even the West is facing a somewhat pivotal time where there's a divergence of views, especially when it comes, for example, to the issue of Palestine. So if you can tell us how this New World Order, with the Islamic Republic being one of them, first of all, how it was able to be part of that, and then for other countries to also go towards that direction.
Absolutely. I mean, what we are witnessing now in the West is that the illusion that the West is one has been completely sort of removed and destroyed. We are seeing even the illusion of democracy is being completely exposed, and we are seeing that in Britain, in France, in United States, between 70% to 80% of population is urging for ceasefire, while the politicians are actually continuing supporting this genocide, and not just verbally, but by gifting equipment and weapons to make this genocide more effective and kill more people. So all this is actually exposed now. I mean, we are seeing a change of ordinary people around the world, West and East and everywhere else, are awakening to the oppression of these colonial institutions and these colonial powers, how they're exposing and they're abusing people, be it in Palestine or what happened in Afghanistan, what happened in Iraq, what happened in Syria. People are awakening. And this is actually a tremendous gift to those who are seeking a better and a juster society. And it sort of makes the case for the politics and the ideology of the Islamic Republic of Iran, i.e. standing against oppression, supporting the oppressed, supporting the resistance, it's becoming a global sort of voice. And I think it's very important to see that the support that Islamic Republic of Iran is giving to the resistance is not just ideological, but technical, and indeed, it's enabling them to stand up with the confidence and stand and look to the horizon to achieve the victory, and is getting support from the masses in Western nations. And I think this is sort of a telltale of a change that we are hoping to see right across the globe, that this oppressive systems, let's look at United States. United States is not just oppressing people in Yemen, in Palestine, in Iraq, or in Afghanistan. Its own citizens, 1% is actually owning and having the power, 85% of the economicals, political, and other powers, and so therefore 99% are being oppressed. So really, I think this exposure of the oppressive nature of the colonial powers is now being exposed, and Palestine is the beginning of it. And I think people are beginning to question this propaganda of the colonial West, United States and Europe, and they're seeing through their lies and false propaganda.
And I'd like to understand from you, Betul Sabedi, why this whole notion of democracy is something that the U.S. has tried to push itself onto other nations, especially Islamic nations, or other nations in general. I mean, I think the most, at least to me, one of the most one of the examples that comes to mind is Afghanistan and how it failed in pushing its own notion of democracy. It's trying to do that with Islamic Republic when it comes to cultural values of one form or another, and it has also failed there. Do you think that that has been a failure for the West, in particular the U.S., that has pushed this notion onto the Islamic Republic, but people have made their minds up that we will stick with the Islamic Republic because that is something we stand for in terms of the ideals that it promotes?
Absolutely. The West's obsession with the notion of democracy and freedom of speech and rule of the law, etc., all these so-called Western values, are really just a projection of the West's insecurity, right? It's enough to see heads of states, for example, in the West, or officials, right, those in official body capacities, being hurled abuse at, whenever they enter conferences or want to give press releases, for example. But if you look at countries like Yemen, for example, or Iran, the moment these individuals in positions of power or authority go out onto the streets, they are welcomed by the people en masse. You know, it's enough for the world to literally have witnessed the funeral of Haj Qasem Soleimani, with over 20 million people turning up, literally crying on the streets. I mean, I would love to see the funerals for those three Americans that were killed by the resistance in Iraq, for example, right? So ultimately, the West is very insecure about its lack of democracy, so to speak. And actually, the strategy of the West is one of imposition. It's one of cooing nations, right? It goes into Ukraine and it very easily does a coup because it doesn't like those in power and it wants to provoke the Russian bear, right? Like that has historically been the American strategy. Even in Iran in 1953, it cooed Mohammad Mossadegh, socialist in power, because it wanted its client states to be in power, right? But then when you had the Islamic Revolution, what was such a breath of fresh air about it was that Imam Khomeini's leadership was such that he expected the people to create the change, not him as an individual. You know, Imam Khomeini led in such a way that the people came to the realization that their presence on the streets is what will bring about the change. The revolution itself, this is an important point, the revolution was led whilst Imam Khomeini was in exile for 14 years. In 1979, when he came back to Iran on this day over 40 years ago, you know, that's when the system essentially fell, right? The system of the Shah. But it's been 14 years in the making before that. Even today, when we look at Iran, the strength comes from its people approving the system. It is through the system that progress and changes are made. You know, if elements prove unworkable in any field, it is a system that has the capacity to renew itself and to absorb any noticeable problems that may surface. And the moment the nation's people, the moment Iran as a nation decides to collectively abandon the Islamic Republic and its leadership, the system will fail to stand as it does today. This is a very important point. The strength of the system of Iran today rests on its people, right? Why was the Maidan coup in 2014 in Ukraine successful? Because there wasn't a strong leadership between the people of Ukraine and Yanukovych in power, for example. In 1953, the coup of Mossadegh was successful because, again, there wasn't a strong kind of psychological link and spiritual relationship with the leadership at that time, right? So the coup had its place. The soft war strategies worked. But in Iran, we're talking about four decades of the worst conspiracy projects, right? Eight-year war where Iran managed to show what it's truly capable of, right? Iran showed that it's inherently a patient nation. Iran has shown what it's able to produce in the worst circumstances and situations. It showed its true colors, essentially, right? In the 1980s, when it was being bombarded from Saddam, from all angles, it still sent its guys to the south of Lebanon to train the men of Hezbollah, right, in order to strengthen them to fight the Israeli occupation entity, right? And Iran, I mean, it's all backfired for the West, right? Because with independence, what does it mean? It means the country has been able to depend on its real power, its domestic resources, right? Right from the start, Iran took an independent line from the superpowers. It explored its own methodologies, its own ways of improving its potentialities in a way that you know, befits any mission or policy they wish to go forward with. And the reality of Iran is that it has only become more powerful with time, more influential. This has become more widespread, and it's only continuing in this project. On this trajectory, Iran's experience is something that is sought after, right? Like Russia seeks Iran's experiences when it comes to circumventing sanctions, right? And overcoming their effects, you know, through the alternative exchanges that are not visible, right? Iran has had to build, as you've mentioned, that resistance economy to turn inwards. So you can argue that actually today, Iran is probably the realest country in the world. It's the realest economy in the truest sense because of its self-sufficiency, because of its lack of external captivity. The reality is that Iran has proven its credibility in dealing with the moral side of principles before taking into account its personal material interests, right? And it has won the confidence and loyalty from not only its allies, but even its enemies. Even the enemies of Iran look towards Iran with prestige. And if you see the way that, for example, America deals with the proxies that it creates, right? America only knows how to deal in proxy terms, only knows how to deal in terms of ordering nations or ordering militias or groups that they create, right? In order to serve their interests. Whereas with Iran, there is a meeting point in the interests between the ideals of the Islamic Revolution and the trajectory of Iran that's seeking freedom and those other entities in the region. And so this idea of proxies that the West tries to project about the resistance axis all being like Iranian-backed proxies, right? That has everything to do with projecting intentions, but it has nothing to do with the reality of actions on the ground, right? It's just a claim to say that Iran has proxies, a smear from an entity that they're desperately trying to isolate, right? Desperately trying to attack. And unfortunately, it's actually been one of the West's most successful cards, right, in smearing the Islamic Republic. But there's been a lot of reversal to this reality of sectarianism in particular post October the 7th. People are realizing the entities who are walking the talk and those Arab states that are lowering their heads in shame and who are the real active and effective forces on the ground.
Sure. There's a lot of different issues that you covered there. Masoud Shajar, I'd like to expand more on what our guest there talked about when she mentioned self-sufficiency. I think that is really important. Prior to that, she talked about how the Islamic Republic has the support of the people. Well, when it comes to the support of the people, the Islamic Republic opened its door for independence. Along with independence came the fact that the West restricted Iran, sanctioned it. And through that, The door was open for Iran to develop its own ambition towards self-sufficiency when it came to a variety of fields. But at the core of it really stood the whole issue of education, where the literacy rate in Iran flourished and advanced under the Islamic Republic. I think that lies at the core, where then we saw advancements that were made in different sectors, from nanotechnology to nuclear technology to even the medical field or the defense field. Is it correct to look at education being at the core of this and how the Islamic Republic advanced Iranians in that regard?
Absolutely. I think it's very important that we need to recognize that that the achievement was due to a number of issues. One is ideological. You know, Islamic Republic was ideological tuned against oppression and an Islamic sort of concept, and which became sort of gave confidence to people in Palestine, people in all around the world who were standing against oppression. You know, let us not forget what happened in Bosnia, what happened in Kashmir, and indeed beyond that. Before that, it was always either you followed the West or the East, and in the Cold War sort of a structure. So that was one thing. The other thing was indeed the achievement. I remember 45 years ago, right after the revolution, when the imposed war was imposed on Iranians, Iran couldn't procurement even barbed wires, bullets, you know, ammunition. Now Iran produces sort of weapons and technology which ensures not its own security, but it's also that technology have been given to all those who are oppressed around the world in the form of groups of resistance around the world, and enables them to stand up and ensure their safety and their security. All this could not happen in vacuum. So it's indeed the education system, the way that literacy was tackled, the way that the number of people who go to university, number of women who actually attend university, number of women who are actually university lecturers. So it really goes in all fields, not just education, liberation of women, addressing the sort of injustices and so forth. All this comes together to create that confidence. And I think, you know, I think we need to sort of understand that the element of Iran not being a nationalistic state is the reason that is being supported, not just in Iran, but indeed right globally. People in Yemen, people in Syria, and in Lebanon, in Palestine, support Iran because Iran's ideology is not a nationalistic ideology. It's an ideology based on Islam, which actually promotes support and change of a global system, which is moves away from colonialism and imperialism into more a system, which is gives empowerment to ordinary people around the world.
Thank you very much for your thoughts. We appreciate it, and it's a pleasure to have you. Masoud Shajar, Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, here in the studios with us. Thank you. Let's bring in Mohsen Saleh now as the Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, who joins us from Toronto. Mohsen Saleh, welcome. So we're looking at Islamic Republic's 45-year anniversary. At this point, maybe I should ask you about what Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi said in his speech. And I thought it was interesting. I don't know if you agree or not. And he said that the threat of military option is not raised against Iran anymore. Of course, the Zionist regime itself putting that aside. That's an interesting point. And it kind of shows, if you agree, how advanced Iran has come when it comes to its defense industry and its deterrence capabilities. Do you agree?
Good morning to you, good morning to your guests, good morning to Iran, to the people of Iran, to the leadership, and to everybody in this enlightening day, in a great day of the revolution and the state and the power, and also the shining model for humanity, because Iran is not now for the Iranians. It's for everybody in the world who would like to see a model example of democracy, of freedom, of committing itself to the just and righteous issues of the world. The Palestinian issue is one of these questions and cases of the world. The resistance, or the axis of the resistance, spread all over the Islamic and the Arab world because of this model of values and ideas. Iran, of course, developed itself, worked on itself, and the people of Iran responded positively and gratefully to the leadership of self-defending and self, actuality of the matters of defense and also of economic things, and tolerate a lot of years of sanctions and attempts of the Americans and the Westerns in order to suffocate this revolution. The revolution succeeded in doing a state, in doing culture, in doing education, and manufacturing a new way of defending itself, which really made the Americans and the Westerns not dare to attack Iran in any place, except for some areas where the Zionist regime and its backers tried collaborators with these powers. Now we are talking about a superpower, not only in the region, in terms of effect, in terms of influence, in terms of working out many things. To give just an example, these drones brought by the Russians or bought by the Russians, this is an example. Also, the rockets and the missiles that the Americans tried to negotiate all over the world about these missiles. Now we are talking about Iran in geo and in ether of the work, in the nano, in economy, in everything, and plus the influence of the justifiable issues like the Palestinian in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, defeating all kinds of terrorists. And now the turn is for the, as Raisi said, to kick out the Israelis from the United Nations. This is a great mission in the world. It didn't happen all over the world, all over the years, all over the decades that the Americans and the Westerns were occupying the minds and the territories of the peoples in the region. And also they have implanted regimes from the beginning of the 20th century. Now we are talking about change in the world. Iran is the first element or the first state and revolution who dared to do these miraculous things. Now we are talking about peoples and the oppressed challenging all the conspiracies of the Americans in Palestine, in Lebanon, and in Syria. They are challenging all the ideas of the Europeans, especially look at Lebanon. Lebanon all over these decades and probably centuries did not reach this peak of power unless this power took its ideas and its philosophy of life from Imam Khomeini, may peace be upon his soul. We see this revolution is expanding, deliberately from all kinds of oppression. The peoples who come, the convoys come from all over the world, and these ambassadors and ministers of foreign affairs from France and from America America and from Germany and all these, they come to Lebanon in order to handle threats to the Lebanese government, and the resistance say no, 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 unless the ceasefire stopped and these massacres stopped from killing the Palestinians in Gaza. We see this is the first example that this independence, which is really has many ramifications on ideas and intellects all over the world, we see a new model of Islam, of course, of the Imam, the Imams of the family of the Prophet, may peace be upon them. And we see a new way of Islam. Even in Islam, there is a new way of dealing with issues, politically, economic, culturally, all these things. They are building a new great, and as much as a human mind can tolerate or can exert, they are building this example for humanity that everybody can participate and work on in order to have dignity and have a new life or a new civilization.
All right, thank you very much for that. Mohsen Saleh there, speaking director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. Thank you for your thoughts from Toronto. Let's cross on over to our reporter, Farzana Ashurian, who joins us. She is somewhere in the capital, Tehran. She is going to tell us as to what's going on there. If you have my voice, Farzana, this is your first time that you're covering the Islamic Revolution, this being the 45 years anniversary. Tell us what you're experiencing out there, and in particular, if you can tell us about Generation Z and how they have grown up with this or have been passed on the different representations that the Islamic Revolution does have.
Exactly, Kaveh. I am here out in the streets in Tehran from 8 a.m. in the morning. From the very early hours of the morning, people were here, and I was talking to them, and I actually did some interview with people from all walks of life, from different generations, with different beliefs. And now it's more than 4 hours that people are actually out in the street to actually support the Islamic Revolution and to actually celebrate the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. And as I said, that I was talking to one of actually young men. He was around 17 years old, and he actually told me that he's here and he could just have his morning sleep, but he decided to come out in the street and to show and express his support for his country, along of course with his friends, and people are holding flags, the Iranian flag, and of course among them the Palestinian flags, and of course they told me that they are out here in the street to support the country and its heroes, such as Haj Qasem Soleimani, who was actually assassinated by the U.S. service attack in 2020. And, of course, we know that one of the most popular mottos of this anniversary, of this actually celebration, is down with the U.S. and down with Israel. And they were chanting those mottos because I actually
looks like we lost Farzana Ashurian, our reporter there, talking to us there from the capital, Tehran. Unfortunately, maybe we'll speak to her later on, I'm not sure, but let's bring on our guests to continue our live coverage. We have let me see over here, Shabir Rizvi, political analyst, who joins us from London. And we also have Julie Qassem, journalist and political analyst, who joins us from Beirut. Welcome to you both. Julie Qassem, I'll start with you. You know, I was just speaking to a reporter there. It was her first time covering the Islamic Revolution's 45-year anniversary, obviously, but just the mere fact that she was of the younger generation. I want to ask you about that, how it is that the Islamic Republic, given the fact that it's 45 years old, has been able to not only pass on its ideals, but for it to gain the popular support generation after generation. Why do you think that is?
So, because the Islamic revolution is a living revolution, it means it adapts. And Khomeini even said this after following the revolution, is that the revolution, the ideas of the revolution, they adapt and they are strengthened by the conditions of their time and place. And what Khomeini did following the Islamic revolution was he shattered the idea that in the Islamic application to society, a holistic Islamic vision of government and society is something in the past, that there is some, there was this always this false notion, and this still is, that there is a dichotomy between Islam. No, he reconciled the two, and he actualized it in what we see as the Islamic Republic of Iran, which actualizes the whole notion of a living revolution. So this is why the message of the Islamic revolution and where we see it present in the Islamic resistance today, whether in Iraq, whether in Lebanon, whether in Palestine, whether in Yemen, it speaks to so many people in its successes in that regard, both domestically, both socially, and both in terms of regional resistance, are so successful and so salient that it continues to both improve and bring itself forward, and as well inspire people around the world to its message. And so the message and the lessons and the process of the Islamic revolution, it is a living process, it is a living revolution, and it continues to inspire people today even more so and even stronger than it did in following 1979.
All right, Shabbat Rizvi, if I may ask you, as our guest there was speaking, let's take a look at some of the images there that I'm seeing of the Iranians who are out in the villages that are showing their respect to and celebrating the Islamic Revolution's 45-year anniversary. One of the things that Imam Khomeini did was, and his administrations even after that, was to advance the infrastructure when it came to the villages and provided the basics that were missing from the despotic Pahlavi regime. Why is it that that wasn't done during the previous regime, and the Islamic Republic moved in on that and made available through the infrastructure improvements to different villages across the country?
Hello. Firstly, congratulations to the Iranian nation and also to the oppressed people globally that this revolution has come of age 45 years and we are still sort of celebrating and hoping for the best for this revolution to continue. However, we are celebrating an event, a momentous event, event that took place in human history during the last century and continues to progress in this century. At the same time, of course, we have a tragic event taking place in Gaza. So my condolences to all the martyrs and their families, and our supplications to the injured and those who are in difficulty at this moment in Gaza. So, congratulations and joy tempered with sadness, if you like, on this particular occasion. Now, insofar as what the Islamic Revolution did to create really authentic institutes, if you like, rather than legacy institutes which were borrowed either from the British Empire or the French Empire or any other European nation, because what we saw subsequent to the revolution and prior to that, that although the colonial powers left countries like India or many African countries, but the bureaucratic and the legal system continues to be borrowed from the nations that were its former masters. While Iran, under Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution, threw away the yoke, the nature of the system was changed. Therefore, you had new sort of institutes which were set up, like Jahasa Zindagi, which was an organization, really, as you quite rightly mentioned, to work in the villages and poorer areas of Iran, because what happens during the Shah's, Reza Shah Pahlavi's period was really total neglect of poorer parts of Iran, rural Iran, and so on. So what Imam Khomeini did through this particular institute was able to provide you know, basic necessities like electricity, water. And not only that, I've been to a couple of African countries where since the advent of the revolution, for instance, in Ghana, the Jahasa Zindagi has been working continuously in Kenya, in Tanzania. So it's not only in Iran, but also sort of improving the lives of the people globally. So that was one institute, if you like, which was set up. Then, of course, you had Bunyad Mustazafin, which was really a foundation for the oppressed, so that funds could be channeled to the oppressed people in Iran. And then, of course, the Revolutionary Guards. And one can continue that the whole bureaucratic structure was changed, because obviously what happens when a revolution does come, and, you know, Imam Ali al-Islam in his letter to Malik Ashtar quite pointedly said that do not include the people from the previous regime who've got their who've got the blood on their hands. So really, whenever a revolution comes, of course, you know, the bureaucrats and the people who run the country are still there, alive, and one has to sort of remove them slowly. Otherwise, there could be a counter-revolution. So, of course, there were bureaucrats who were embedded in the system, but slowly they moved away and the younger generation came into existence who have been able to carry the revolution. And, of course, the whole idea of exporting the revolution was fundamental. It wasn't exporting the revolution through the barrel of the gun, if you like. It was really exporting the revolution by inspiring people who were oppressed globally to stand up and really get rid of the oppressors. And we can see that, as our other panelist from Lebanon was saying, that it has resonated, it has inspired, it has motivated organizations like Hezbollah, Iraqi resistance, what's happening in Yemen. The whole of axis of resistance has come about because of this exporting of the revolution. Not only is it confined just to the West Asian nations, but it has gone as far as Venezuela and other nations in Africa who have been inspired by the Islamic Revolution. And, you know, just to sort of remind your esteemed viewers, is that when Mandela visited Iran after South Africa was liberated from the white, racist, supremacist, apartheid regime, he visited the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Ayatollah Khamenei, and said that you are my leader. So really, you know, revolutionaries like Mandela were also inspired by the Islamic Revolution, and they actually articulated their inspiration in a very powerful way.
Okay. Well, let's bring in Ali Risk now. He's a political analyst who also joins us from Beirut. Ali Risk, welcome. You know, when you take a look at the way that Iran has... okay, I'll go with Julia Qassem. Ali Risk will be joining us shortly, hopefully. Julia Qassem, when you take a look at how the Islamic Republic has stood against the U.S., it wasn't the mere fact that it was against the U.S., for reasons such as it being sanctioned by the U.S. It was against its foreign policy adventures, specifically in the region. We saw what happened for example, Iraq. We saw what happened to, for example, Afghanistan and then Yemen. But when it comes to the way that the U.S. has assisted and perhaps executed and even overlooking the U.S. genocidal war, Israel genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, I think the world has taken notice that the U.S. is using a militaristic approach that perhaps is unparalleled when it comes to the genocide that's taking place. Do you think that because of the Islamic Republic, in some respects, Many have now understood why Iran has stood for Palestine in the form and manner that it has.
I mean, absolutely. For decades, Iran was the only, you know, major power in the region that had been giving substantial support for groups in the region to liberate themselves and to fight off occupation, whether U.S. or Israeli. And as we can see, all of the major leaders of the resistance groups in Gaza, in Palestine, whether it is the PFLP, whether it is the Palestinian Islamic Jihad or Hamas, all of the leaders had pledged solidarity and support to the Islamic Republic for providing them with not only the material support necessary to fight the occupation, but for the coordination, for the continued political commitment and support that the Islamic Republic has given to the Palestinian cause, which has percolated into its support and coordination for other resistance groups in the region to fight off the occupiers of the support supporters of the occupation, whether Saudi Arabia or the United States. So the Islamic Revolution puts support for Palestine back on the map, because for decades the Arabs had faced defeat after defeat. They were not properly organized, properly coordinated. Even if we had admirable leaders in our history, there wasn't this the holistic and the complete nexus of resistance that there is today that worked in tandem with one another and worked as part of a complete units of principled and consistent, in a principled and consistent fight that we see to the level of today. So the Islamic resistance, both in a spiritual sense, in an ideological sense, in a material sense, it brought up the necessary organization that brought the Arabs out of the complete, the decades of shame and the decades of defeat, and brought it into what Sayyid Nasrallah said in 2000, following the liberation from Israeli occupation of Lebanon, that this is the era of victories. And we can thank the Islamic Republic of Iran for providing the foundation for that.
Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it, Julia Qassam. Julia Qassam, political analyst from Beirut. Thank you for your input. We're going to say goodbye to you and continue with Shabir Rezvi. Shabir Rezvi, on the economic front, there's been some major strides that have been made throughout the years and decades. Just in the past couple of weeks, it turned out that when it comes to Iran's